Kirsten was a black writer. Her dates are 1903 to 1960. And she, when she was writing, she was not a part of the mainstream high-toned culture. She's more or less been discovered fairly recently. This story is dated 1926. It's set in Florida, and it's pretty scary stuff. So I'll be really interested to hear what your responses to it are. And I will read it through, and then we'll just talk about how we respond to it. So if we want to start the tape, this is a session on women writers talking about women and work, and the issue is violence in connection with work. My name is Rinda West. The story is Sweat by Zora Neale Hurston. I'm not going to be very good on the dialect, so forgive me when I come to dialogue. Be patient. It was 11 o'clock of a spring night in Florida. It was Sunday. Any other night, Delia Jones would have been in bed for 2 hours by this time. But she was a washwoman, and Monday morning meant a great deal to her. So she collected the soiled clothes on Saturday when she returned the clean things. Sunday night, after church, she sorted them and put the white things to soak. It saved her almost a half day's start. A great hamper in the bedroom held the clothes that she brought home. It was so much neater than a number of bundles lying around. She squatted in the kitchen floor beside the great pile of clothes, sorting them into small heaps according to color and humming a song in a mournful key, but wondering through it all where Sykes, her husband, had gone with her horse and buckboard. Just then, something long, round, limp, and black fell upon her shoulders and slithered to the floor beside her. A great terror took hold of her. It softened her knees and dried her mouth so that it was a full minute before she could cry out or move. Then she saw that it was the big bull whip her husband liked to carry when he drove. She lifted her eyes to the door and saw him standing there bent over with laughter at her fright. She screamed at him, "Sykes, why you throw that whip on me like that? You know it would scare me. Looks just like a snake, and you knows how scared I is of snakes." "Of course I knowed it. That's how come I done it." He slapped his leg with his hand and almost rolled on the ground in his mirth. "If you such a big fool that you got to have a fit over a earthworm or a string, I don't care how bad I scare you. You ain't got no business doing it. God knows it's a sin. Someday I'm going to drop dead from some of your foolishness. Another thing, where you been with my rig? I feeds that pony. He ain't for you to be driving with no bullwhip." "You show is one aggravating nigger woman," he declared and stepped into the room. She resumed her work and did not answer him at once. "I done told you time and again to keep them white folks' clothes out of this house." He picked up the whip and glared down at her. Delia went on with her work. She went out into the yard and returned with a galvanized tub and set it on the wash bench. She saw that Sykes had kicked all of the clothes together again and now stood in her way truculently, his whole manner hoping, praying for an argument. But she walked calmly around him and commenced to resort the things. "Next time I'm going to kick him outdoors," he threatened as he struck a match along the leg of his corduroy breeches. Delia never looked up from her work, and her thin, stooped shoulders sagged further. "I ain't for no fuss tonight, Sykes. I just come from taking sacrament at the church house." He snorted scornfully. "Yeah, you just come from de church house on a Sunday night, but here you is going to work on them clothes. You ain't nothing but a hypocrite. One of them amen corner Christians sing, whoop, and shout, then come home and wash white folks' clothes on the Sabbath." He stepped roughly upon the whitest pile of things, kicking them helter-skelter as he crossed the room. His wife gave a little scream of dismay and quickly gathered them together again. "Sykes, you quit grinding dirt into these clothes. How can I get through by Saturday if I don't start on Sunday?" "I don't care if you never get through. Anyhow, I done promised God and a couple of other men I ain't going to have it in my house. Don't give me no lip neither, else I'll throw 'em out. Put my fist upside your head to boot." Delia's habitual meekness seemed to slip from her shoulders like a blown scarf. She was on her feet, her poor little body, her bare knuckly hands bravely defying the strapping hulk before her. "Look a here, Sykes, you done gone too fur. I've been married to you for 15 years and I've been taking in washing for 15 years. Sweat, sweat, sweat. Working sweat, crying sweat, praying sweat." "What's that got to do with me?" he asked brutally. "What's it got to do with you, Sykes?
My tub of suds has filled your belly with vittles more times than your hands has filled it. My sweat has done paid for this house, and I reckon I can keep on sweating in it.
She seized the iron skillet from the stove and struck a defensive pose, which act surprised him greatly coming from her. It cowed him, and he did not strike her as he usually did.
"No, you won't," she panted. "That old snaggle-toothed black woman you running with ain't coming here to pile on my sweat and blood. You ain't paid for nothing on this place, and I'm going to stay here right here till I'm toted out foot foremost. Well, you better quit getting me riled up, else they be toting you out sooner than you expect. I'm so tired of you, I don't know what to do. God, how I hate skinny women."
A little awed by this new Delia, he sidled out of the door and slammed the back gate after him. He did not say where he had gone, but she knew too well. She knew very well that he would not return until nearly daybreak also. Her work over, she went on to bed, but not to sleep at once. Things had come to a pretty pass. She lay awake, gazing upon the debris that cluttered their matrimonial trail. Not an image left standing along the way. Anything like flowers had long ago been drowned in the salty stream that had been pressed from her heart. Her tears, her sweat, her blood. She had brought love to the union, and he had brought a longing after the flesh. 2 months after the wedding, he had given her the first brutal beating. She had the memory of his numerous trips to Orlando with all of his wages, when he had returned to her penniless, even before the first year passed. She was young and soft then, but now she thought of her knotty, muscled limbs, her harsh, knuckly hands, and drew herself up into an unhappy little ball in the middle of the big feather bed. Too late now to hope for love. Even if it were not Bertha, it would be someone else. The case differed from the others only in that she was bolder than the others. Too late for everything except her little home. She had built it for her old days and planted one by one the trees and flowers there. It was lovely to her, lovely. Somehow, before sleep came, she found herself saying aloud, "Oh, well, whatever goes over the devil's back has got to come under his belly. Sometime or other, Sykes, like everybody else, is going to reap his sowing." After that, she was able to build a spiritual earthworks against her husband. His shells could no longer reach her. Amen. She went to sleep and slept until he announced his presence in bed by kicking her feet and rudely snatching the covers away.
"Give me some kiva here, and get your damn foots on over on your own side. I'll mash you on your mouth for drawing that skillet on me."
Delia went clear to the rail without answering him. Triumphant indifference to all that he was or did. The week was as full of work for Delia as all other weeks, and Saturday found her behind her little pony collecting and delivering clothes. It was a hot, hot day near the end of July. The village men on Joe Clark's porch even chewed cane listlessly. They did not hurl the cane knots as usual. They let them dribble over the edge of the porch. Even conversation had collapsed under the heat. "Here come Delia Jones," Jim Merchant said as the shaggy pony came round the bend of the road toward them. The rusty buckboard was heaped with baskets of crisp, clean laundry.
"Yep," Joe Lindsay agreed. "Hot or cold, rain or shine, just as regular as the weeks roll round, Delia carries them and fetches them on Saturday."
"She better if she want her eat," said Moss. "Syke Jones ain't worth the shot and powder it would take to kill him. Not to her, he ain't."
"He sho ain't," Walter Thomas chimed in. "It's too bad, too, 'cause she was a right pretty little trick when he got her. I'd have married him myself if he hadn't beat me to it."
Delia nodded briefly at the men as she drove past.
"Too much knocking will ruin any woman. He done beat enough to kill three women, let alone change their looks," said Elijah Mosley. "How Syke can stomach that big black greasy mogul he's laying round with gets me. I swear that eight rock couldn't kiss a sardine can I done throwed out the back door way last year."
"Aw, she's fat, that's how come. He's allus been crazy about fat women," put in Merchant. "He'd have been tied up with one long time ago if he could have found one to have him."
"Did I tell you about him come sidling round my wife?"
"Bringing her a basket of pecans out of his yard for a present?"
"Yes, sir, my wife. She told him to take him right straight back home, 'cause Delia worked so hard over dat washtub she reckon everything on de place tastes like sweat and soap suds.
I just wished I'd have caught him running round dere. I'd have made his hips catch on fire down dat shell road."
"I know he done it, too. I sees him grinning at every woman that passes," Walter Thomas said. "But even so, he used to eat some mighty big hunks of humble pie to get that little woman he got. She was as pretty as a speckled pup. That was 15 years ago. He used to be so scared of losing her, she could make him do some parts of a husband's duty. They never was the same in de mind."
"There ought to be a law about him," said Lindsay. "He ain't fit to carry guts to a bear."
Clark spoke for the first time.
'Tain't no law on earth that can make a man be decent if it ain't in him. There's plenty men that takes a wife like they do a joint of sugar cane. It's round, juicy, and sweet when they gets it. But they squeeze and grind, and wring till they wring every drop of pleasure that's in a man. When they's satisfied that they's wrung dry, they treats them just like they do a cane chew. They throws them away. They knows what they's doing while they's at it. Hates theyselves for it, but they keeps on hanging after her till she's empty. Then they hates her for being a cane chew and in the way. We ought to take Syke and that stray woman of his down to Lake Hallwell Swamp and lay on the rawhide till they can't say law of mercy. He always was a overbearing nigger, but since that white woman from up north done teached him how to run an automobile, he got too biggity to live, and we ought to kill him, old man Anderson advised. A grunt of approval went around the porch, but the heat was melting their civic virtue, and Elijah Mosley began to bait Joe Clark. Come on, Joe, get a milling now. Out of there and slice it up for your customers. We's all suffering with the heat. De bears done got me. That's right, Joe. A watermelon is just what I needs to cure the epizetics. Walter Thomas joined forces with Mosley. Come on, dear Joe. We is steady customers, and you ain't set us up in a long time. I chooses that long, bow-legged Florida favorite. A garden bedeau, y'all. Give me 20 cents and slice away, Clark retorted. I needs a cold slice myself. Here, everybody chip in. I'll lend y'all my meat knife. The money was quickly subscribed, and the huge melon brought forth. At that moment, Sykes and Bertha arrived. A determined silence fell on the porch, and the melon was put away again. Merchant snapped down the blade of his jackknife and moved toward the store door. Come on in, Joe, and give me a slab of sow belly and a pound of coffee. Almost forgot 'twas Saturday. Got to get on home. Most of the men left also. Just then Delia drove past on her way home, as Sykes was ordering magnificently for Bertha. It pleased him for Delia to see.
Get whatsoever your heart desires, honey. Wait a minute, Joe. Give her 2 bottles of strawberry soda water, a quart of parched ground peas, and a block of chewing gum.
With all this, they left the store, with Sykes reminding Bertha that this was his town, and she could have it if she wanted it. The men returned soon after they left and held their watermelon feast.
Where did Sykes Jones get that woman from, nohow? Lindsay asked.
Over at Popka. Guess they must have been cleaning out to town when she left. She don't look like a thing but a hunk of liver with hair on it.
Well, she sure can squall, Dave Carter contributed. When she gets ready to laugh, she just opens her mouth and latches it back to the last notch. No old Grandpa Alligator down in Lake Bell ain't got nothing on her.
Bertha had been in town 3 months now. Sykes was still paying her room rent at Della Lewis's, the only house in town that would have taken her in. Sykes took her frequently to Winter Park, to Stomp's. He still assured her that he was the swellest man in the state.
Show yo can have that little old house soon's I can get that woman out of there.
Everything belongs to me, and you show can have it. I show abominates a skinny woman.
Lordy, you show he's got one potly shape on you. You can get anything you wants. This is my town, and you show can have it.
Delia's work-worn knees crawled over the earth in Gethsemane and up the rocks of Calvary many, many times during these months. She avoided the villagers and meeting places in her efforts to be blind and deaf, but Bertha nullified this to a degree by coming to Delia's house to call Sykes out to her at the gate. Delia and Sykes fought all the time now with no peaceful interludes. They slept and ate in silence. 2 or 3 times Delia had attempted a timid friendliness, but she was repulsed each time. It was plain that the breaches must remain agape. The sun had burned July to August. The heat streamed down like a million hot arrows, smiting all things living upon the earth. Grass withered, leaves browned, snakes went blind in shedding, and men and dogs went mad. Dog days. Delia came home one day and found Sykes there before her. She wondered, but started to go into the house without speaking, even though he was standing in the kitchen door, and she must either stoop under his arm or ask him to move. He made no room for her. She noticed a soap box beside the steps, but paid no particular attention to it, knowing that he must have brought it in there. As she was stooping to pass under his outstretched arm, he suddenly pushed her backwards, laughingly.
Look in de box, dear Delia. I done brung you something.
She nearly fell upon the box in her stumbling, and when she saw what it held, she all but fainted outright.
Sike! Sike, my God! You take that rattlesnake away from here! You gotta... Oh, Jesus, have mercy!
I ain't got to do nothing of the kind. Fact is, I ain't got to do nothing but die. 'Tain't no use of you putting on airs making out like you scared of that snake. He going to stay right here till he die. He wouldn't bite me 'cause I knows how to handle him. No, how he wouldn't risk breaking out his fangs, gin yo skinny legs. Now, Sight, don't keep that thing round here to scare me to death. You knows I'm even feared of earthworms. That's the biggest snake I ever did see. Kill him, Sight, please.
Don't ask me to do nothing for ya, going round trying to be so damn asturperious. No, I ain't gonna kill it. I think a damn sight more of him than you. That's a nice snake, and anybody don't like him can just hit the grit.
The village soon heard that Sykes had the snake and came to see and ask questions.
How the henfire did you catch that 6-foot rattler, Syke?
Thomas asked.
He's full of frogs, so he can't hardly move, that's how. I eased up on him, but I'm a snake charmer. Knows how to handle him. Shucks, that ain't nothing. I could catch one every day if I so wanted to.
What he needs is a heavy hickory club leaned real heavy on his head. That's the best way to charm a rattlesnake.
No, wait. You just don't understand these diamondbacks like I do, said Sykes in a superior tone of voice.
The village agreed with Walter, but the snake stayed on. His box remained by the kitchen door with its screen wire covering. 2 or 3 days later, it had digested its meal of frogs and literally came to life. It rattled at every movement in the kitchen or the yard. One day, as Delia came down the kitchen steps, she saw his chalky white fangs curved like scimitars hung in the wire meshes. This time she did not run away with averted eyes as usual. She stood for a long time in the doorway in a red fury that grew bloodier for every second that she regarded the creature that was her torment. That night she broached the subject as soon as Sykes sat down to the table.
Sykes, I want you to take that snake away from here. You done starved me and I put up with you. You done beat me and I took that. But you done killed all my insides bringing that varmint here.
Sykes poured out a saucer full of coffee and drank it deliberately before he answered her.
A whole lot I care about how you feels inside out. That snake ain't going no damn where till I gets ready for him to go. So fur as beating is concerned, you ain't took near all that you going to take if you stay round me.
Delia pushed back her plate and got up from the table.
I hate you, Sykes, she said calmly. I hates you to the same degree that I used to love you. You done took and took till my belly is full up to my neck. That's the reason I got my letter from the church and I moved my membership to Woodbridge, so I don't have to take no sacrament with you. I don't want to see you round me at all. Lay round with that woman all you wants to, but go away from me and my house. I hates you like a suck-egg dog.
Sykes almost let the huge wad of cornbread and collard greens he was chewing fall out of his mouth in amazement. He had a hard time whipping himself up to the proper fury to try and answer Delia.
Well, I'm glad you does hate me. I'm so tired of you hanging on to me. I don't want you. Look at your stringy old neck. Your raw bony legs and arms is enough to cut a man to death. You looks just like the devil's doll baby to me. You can't hate me no worse than I hates you. I've been hating you for years. Your old black hide don't look like nothing to me but a passel of wrinkled up rubber with your old big ears flapping on each side like a pair of buzzard wings. Don't think I'm going to be run away from my house neither. I'm going to the white folks about you, my young man, the very next time you lay your hands on me. My cup is done run over.
Delia said this with no sign of fear and Sykes departed from the house threatening her, but made not the slightest move to carry out any of them. That night he did not return at all, and the next day, being Sunday, Delia was glad she didn't have to quarrel before she hitched up her pony and drove the 4 miles to Woodbridge. She stayed to the night service, Love Feast, which was very warm and full of spirit. In the emotional winds, her domestic trials were borne far and wide, so that she sang as she drove homeward, Jordan water, black and cold, chills de body, not de soul, and I want to cross Jordan in a calm time. She came from the barn to the kitchen door and stopped.
What de matter, old Satan? You ain't kicking up your racket?
She addressed the snake's box. Complete silence. She went on into the house with a new hope in its birth struggles. Perhaps her threat to go to the white folks had frightened Sykes. Perhaps he was sorry. 15 years of misery and suppression had brought Delia to the place where she would hope anything that looked towards a way over or through her wall of inhibitions. She felt in the match safe behind the stove at once for a match. There was only one there.
That nigger wouldn't fetch nothing here to save his rotten neck, but he can run through what I brings quick enough. Now he done toted off nigh on to half a box of matches. He done had that woman here in my house, too.
Nobody but a woman could tell how she knew this even before she struck the match. But she did, and it put her into a new fury. Presently she brought the tubs to put the white things to soak. This time she decided she need not bring her hamper out of the bedroom. She would go in there and do the sorting.
She picked up the pot-bellied lamp and went in. The room was small, and the hamper stood hard by the foot of the white iron bed. She could sit and reach through the bedposts, resting as she worked. "I want to cross Jordan in a calm time," she was singing again. The mood of the love feast had returned. She threw back the lid of the basket almost gaily. Then, moved by both horror and terror, she sprang back toward the door. There lay the snake in the basket. He moved sluggishly at first, but even as she turned round and round, jumped up and down in an insanity of fear, he began to stir vigorously. She saw him pouring his awful beauty from the basket upon the bed. Then she seized the lamp and ran as fast as she could to the kitchen. The wind from the open door blew out the light, and the darkness added to her terror. She sped to the darkness of the yard, slamming the door after her, before she thought to set down the lamp. She didn't feel safe, even on the ground, so she climbed up in the hay barn. There, for an hour or more, she lay sprawled upon the hay, a gibbering wreck. Finally, she grew quiet, and after that, coherent thought. With this, stalked through her a cold, bloody rage. Hours of this, a period of introspection, a space of retrospection, then a mixture of both. Out of this, an awful calm. "Well, I done the best I could. If things ain't right, God knows, tain't my fault." She went to sleep, a twitch sleep, and woke up to a faint gray sky. There was a loud, hollow sound below. She peered out. Sykes was at the woodpile, demolishing a wire-covered box. He hurried to the kitchen door, but hung outside there some minutes before he entered, and stood some minutes more inside before he closed it after him. The gray in the sky was spreading. Delia descended without fear now and crouched beneath the low bedroom window. The drawn shade shut out the dawn, shut in the night, but the thin walls held back no sound. "That old scratch has woke up now," she mused at the tremendous whirr inside, which every woodsman knows is one of the sound illusions. The rattler is a ventriloquist. His whirr sounds to the right, to the left, straight ahead, behind, close underfoot, everywhere but where it is. Woe to him who guesses wrong unless he's prepared to hold up his end of the argument. Sometimes he strikes without rattling at all. Inside, Sykes heard nothing until he knocked a pot lid off the stove while trying to reach the match safe in the dark. He had emptied his pockets at Bertha's. The snake seemed to wake up under the stove, and Sykes made a quick leap into the bedroom. In spite of the gin he had, his head was clearing now. "My God!" he chattered. "If I could only strike a light!" The rattling ceased for a moment, and he stood paralyzed. He waited. It seemed that the snake waited also. "Oh, for the light! I thought he'd be too sick," Sykes was muttering to himself when the whir began again, closer, right underfoot this time. Long before this, Sykes's ability to think had been flattened down to a primitive instinct, and he leaped onto the bed. Outside, Delia heard a cry that might have come from a maddened chimpanzee, a stricken gorilla. All the terror, all the horror, all the rage that man possibly could express without a recognizable human sound. A tremendous stir inside there, another series of animal screams, the intermittent whir of the reptile. The shade torn violently down from the window, letting in the red dawn, a huge brown hand seizing the window stick, great dull blows upon the wooden floor, punctuating the gibberish of sound long after the rattle of the snake had abruptly subsided. All this Delia could see and hear from her place beneath the window, and it made her ill. She crept over to the 4 o'clock and stretched herself on the cool earth to recover. She lay there. "Delia! Delia!" She could hear Sykes calling in a most despairing tone, as one who expected no answer. The sun crept on up, and he called. Delia could not move. Her legs were gone flabby. She never moved. He called, and the sun kept rising. "My God," she heard him moan. "My God from heaven." She heard him stumbling about and got up from her flower bed. The sun was growing warm. As she approached the door, she heard him call out hopefully, "Delia, is that you I hear?" She saw him on his hands and knees as soon as she reached the door. He crept an inch or two toward her, all that he was able, and she saw his horribly swollen neck and his one open eye shining with hope. A surge of pity, too strong to support, bore her away from that eye that must, could not fail to see the tubs. He would see the lamp. Orlando, with its doctors, was too far. She could scarcely reach the chinaberry tree, where she waited in the growing heat, while inside she knew the cold river was creeping up and up to extinguish that eye which must know by now that she knew.
true. It still would have been there. That's true. I took it as him thinking his mission was accomplished. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's try and reconstruct. What's his state of mind when he comes back home at dawn?
He's drunk.
He's drunk, for one thing.
He's hoping to find her dead.
He's triumphant. He's hoping to find her dead. And then what's going to happen once he finds her dead?
He can move Bertha.
He can move Bertha in, right. He can prove to Bertha what a man he is by bringing Bertha into the house. And do you think he's thinking about the snake at all? What do you think he thinks is the condition of the snake?
He thinks the snake has bitten her and gone on.
Just sluggish again.
Yeah.
Right, it's swallowed all its frogs, hasn't it?
Yep.
So that's what he thinks, and he comes home and he smashes up the snake's box. And what's going on with that?
Maybe she would think that, maybe the authorities would think that something had happened to the box and the snake had gotten loose and gotten into an accident.
So maybe he's covering his responsibility for that. That's a possibility.
He doesn't seem that intelligent.
Well?
Somehow I had a feeling that he was smashing the box for fun because it made him happy to smash boxes. It was a nice, violent thing to do. Yes, I have triumphed.
I think he was delaying going in the house to make sure she was dead.
That's an interesting thought.
Because he went in slowly. He stood for a long time outside the door. Mm-hmm. And then once he was inside, he stood for a long time listening and waiting.
He's listening for quiet, isn't he? He wants it to be quiet in there. So maybe smashing up the box is a way of testing to see if she's going to come out when she hears the noise. So how much of this, what do you suppose is running through her mind as she's sitting up there in the hay barn? Well, let me go back and read you a couple of lines there.
She goes straight to the bedroom window, though.
She goes straight to the bedroom window, but she gets up into the hay barn. There, for an hour or more, she lay sprawled upon the hay, a gibbering wreck. But finally she grew quiet, and after that, coherent thought. With this stalked through her a cold, bloody rage. Hours of this, a period of introspection, a space of retrospection, then a mixture of both. Out of this, an awful calm.
This story to me is all about violent and nonviolent resistance. She'd been taking beatings from the second month of her marriage for 15 years, passively.
Mm-hmm.
She never raised a hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then she raised the frying pan toward him. And she found out, it implied in the story that as she raised the frying pan, he cowered a little bit. That for the first time she found out that maybe passive resistance wasn't the way to go. And when she was sitting up in the hayloft, she was passive, but I think that cold chill or whatever it was that came over her, she crossed that line again. She went from nonviolent to violent resistance. It was more than passive.
She goes through three stages. The first one is the frying pan, when she raises the frying pan at him. The second is when she threatens to go to the white folks, and she says to him, I hate you, which presumably she'd never said before. And then the third one is this, when she doesn't act.
She just doesn't not act.
That's right. It's
It'd be pretty hard to act. You know, you'd say, there is your murderer walking around down there, jubilant because you're supposed to be dead, and it's absolute suicide to open your mouth and say anything because he'll still want to be rid of her. He'll find another way.
And he'll know that she knows that he was trying to kill her.
That's right.
Which makes it all the more pressing need for him to get rid of her.
The thing that struck me was when he called Delia, Delia, and she didn't answer.
Isn't that interesting?
That to me was that was her action. For not coming to his rescue.
There's a couple of times when she could have come to his rescue, aren't there? She could have come to his rescue when she first saw him in the hay barn. She could have come to his rescue when she's sitting outside the bedroom window. She could have maybe opened the window, called to him, and then she could have come to him when he called Delia, Delia.
It's interesting that he called Delia, Delia.
Isn't it? Mm-hmm. Isn't it? But at the end, it's not exactly remorse, but it's a cry for help.
But that he even thought that she would or could help.
Yeah, that he thought that she would help is really extraordinary, isn't it?
But there's
she'd always been his caretaker, right. That's right. That's a good point. She'd always come through. She'd taken the beatings, she'd taken the neglect, she'd taken all the other kinds of abuse and continued to put food on his table. Right.
I'm sure she also realized, though, that up until the time that the snake bit him, her life was still at stake. He could have still gotten the snake to bite her up until the time it bit him.
Mm-hmm.
If she would have walked in the front door and warned him about the snake, it was still risky for her.
Yeah. And he's presented in the story as a very powerful figure, a physically very powerful figure and a real threat to her. What do you make of the very end when she realizes that he knew? Anybody have any thoughts about that? Well, I'll read you the very last paragraph again. The story's a deliberately confusing about what exactly has gone on. So maybe it would help if we tried to reconstruct exactly what happened. There's this big hamper where she normally puts the clothes to sort them. And he's put the snake in the hamper. She is going to turn out the hamper to turn out the clothes. And the snake comes out instead. Or she sees the snake. Maybe she's only got the hamper tipped. And she sees the snake. Maybe she hasn't put the clothes in it. It's not altogether clear. But the snake goes onto the bed. And that's what he doesn't know. And she then runs out into the living room. And the lamp goes out. And she puts down the lamp. And she runs outside. It's dark when he comes in. And of course he can't get a match because there isn't a match left. Because he only left one match in there for her. And she used it. Right. And he doesn't know where the snake is, and it's pitch black. And he goes onto the bed, thinking that the snake is on the floor. And he gets into the fray with the snake. He grabs the stick and starts beating the snake, and presumably kills the snake after the snake has bitten him. But then he comes out, and she saw him on his hands and knees as soon as she reached the door. He crept an inch or two toward her, all that he was able, and she saw his horribly swollen neck and his one open eye shining with hope. A surge of pity too strong to support bore her away from that eye that must, could not fail to see the tubs. So he sees what? He sees that she's brought out the tubs.
That she's in the house, that she had been in the house, and she knew that he had a snake in there.
Right. He knows that she knows the snake is in there and is going to get him. So, in a sense, that completes her vengeance. Because he doesn't die not knowing whether or not she knew, but he dies knowing.
What he tried in secret, she accomplished.
Right.
Through his knowledge.
Right.
It's real power.
It is powerful, isn't it? There are a couple of interesting patterns of imagery that you may not have picked up as I was reading it, because I think there's a lot of times you don't hear things when you just hear it once. But you remember the first thing that he comes and threatens her with is the whip?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Snake-like. Maybe I thought it was a snake.
Right. The whip is very snake-like. And then he becomes the person who brings the snake. What does it do to your response to him, to have him be a character who's associated with whips and snakes?
You never like him. He's never sympathetic.
You can never like him, can you? But what do you associate with whips, and what do you associate with snakes?
Abusiveness.
Specifically, who do you associate with whips?
Slavery?
Slave drivers, absolutely. That's what the overseers used, isn't it? So he becomes her overseer. And what about snakes? Who do you associate with snakes?
Satan,
yeah. And she calls the snake old devil, doesn't she? So although Hurston doesn't ever try to take the character out of the literal plane, she uses those images to create part of our emotional response to him, that if you have, as most people have, some kind of aversion to snakes and whips, then that just it gives a kind of emotional power around him. But I think also the whole imagery of her relationship to her church is very important in the story. Mm-hmm. How did that strike you as I read it?
Yeah, the fact that her main, like, striking out against him was her moving her church, that she wasn't going to take the sacrament from him.
Mm-hmm.
And that her singing the hymns was what calmed her, what steadied her,
mm-hmm.
what brought her through it.
Mm-hmm. Anything else strike you about her, about the religious imagery in the story and the connection with her congregation?
The imagery of her crawling through Gethsemane and Calvary day after day.
Right, mm-hmm. right. That he was her cross, in a sense. Mm-hmm. The hymn she's singing as she comes home from this very emotional service, which has really helped her and given her a lot of strength. And I think that, you know, you remember the period when Bertha's in town, she has to avoid people, or she feels she has to avoid people because of the humiliation of Sykes carrying on with this other woman. And so she moves her church, and that is also a way for her to get a sense of community that's away from the place where she feels so much humiliation. So she goes to this service, and it gives her lots of strength, and she comes home singing, Jordan water, black and cold, chills the body, not the soul. And I want to cross Jordan in a calm time.
So you think she's going to go home, and she's going to be the one that's going to die.
So maybe you think she's going to be the one that's going to die.
But calmly, I mean, well, that doesn't mean... She could die violently, but cross it in a calm time, I suppose.
She wants a calm time. What happens to her?
She gets it.
She gets a calm, doesn't she?
She sure does.
She sure does. She has to go through terrific fear and rage. And you remember how important anger is in the story? There are several times where it talks about her usual meekness slipped from her shoulders like a blown scarf, and she turns aggressive to him. As you were saying, Bob, it's like the story involves an escalation of resistance and then a place at which there seems to be a corner she turns around to accept some responsibility for that final act.
Yeah, I don't understand. What do you think about the final, like, what's the very last line?
She could scarcely reach the chinaberry tree where she waited in the growing heat while inside she knew, and here's the telling phrase, the cold river was creeping up and up to extinguish that eye, which must know by now that she knew.
So what does that make her? What role does that assign her? She's been the one going, you know, battling. She's been the force of good, and he's been evil.
Mm-hmm.
And all the imagery seems to do that, and she's against the snake and the cross, or she's...
Bearing the cross,
her,
right.
Bearing the cross, and she's against the whip. And then in the end, she's sort of complicit in the death. She becomes a murderer in a way. How does it work?
Well, let's throw that out for...
I think she becomes her own savior.
Right.
This time they didn't crucify the wrong person.
I don't think of her as a murderer.
He killed himself. He plotted his own death. It just turned out to be he was the victim instead of Jesus.
My first reaction was that she survived his murder, that she could live through that, at least at that point.
That her knowledge and her owning of that death and her choosing not to interrupt that death puts her in a different position than if she had been helpless in the face of it.
Yeah, I think it's slightly more than simply self-defense. Although, in one way, you can make a case that, in any court of law, she'd get off on a self-defense plea, wouldn't she?
Probably would never go to court.
It would probably never, well... Certainly sociologically it would never go to a court of law, but if we were even to assume a just society, that she would get off on a plea of self-defense. But I think Hurston wants us to see her as at least partly morally acquiescent in his death. because she feels a pity at the very end. Remember that? The pity's almost more than she can bear. A surge of pity too strong to support bore her away from that eye.
But there's something horrifying about that eye and about the rising tide extinguishing the remaining eye, and her, it makes her more active in the death. It makes her less of a passive person.
Now, wasn't there a line in there that said one town, there was a time, just that one sentence where it, like, that the town was too far away.
Right.
Like if she had chosen to go for help or getting to help, you know, so that maybe to justify to herself that there wouldn't be anything she could do about it even if she wanted to.
That's right.
It says
Orlando and its doctors was too far.
Yeah.
There really was nothing she could do to save his life. But nonetheless, she does nothing.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, she does nothing.
She certainly doesn't comfort him. That's something she could have done.
She certainly doesn't comfort him, but what rises to extinguish the eye is a cold river, which I think is interesting.
It chills
the body, but not the soul. That's right. And I think that I was interested as I read the story in how despicable he is. I mean, he's just unrelievedly villainous. There is nothing in the story that humanizes him at all. He's brutal to her. He's arrogant. He's a womanizer. And even with the woman that he seems to be interested in, he just does the most sort of obnoxious parody of the American, the man is worth something because of the weight that he can throw around or what he can buy for her. You can have, this is my town, you can have anything you
want.
Even the other men hate him, right. And I wondered if other people would think that he was overwritten.
No. I had according to my grandmother, I had a great-grandfather like that.
Really?
No, not overwritten. He was, he discriminated with his children. There was one that could do no wrong, and which was my grandfather. My grandfather hated that. He was cruel to his other children. He was mean to his grandchildren. He was a terror with his wife. She had terrible asthma, and he'd go smoke in her face on purpose. And I suppose he had a few redeeming characteristics, you know, and maybe even this character did. We don't know his whole life, but I don't...
She must have had something there.
I don't think
at the beginning for her to love him so much.
Well, yeah, but he made some pretty stupid mistakes in the name of love, you know.
The fact that
the beatings didn't start until they were married to him. Right, the beatings didn't start
until she was married to him for 2 months. And
that happens
a lot in domestic violence. Yeah. I don't think they're any more unbelievable than a character of Alice Walker or Toni Morrison.
Yeah.
Very similar in there.
You had to hate him.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no way you can identify with that man. He's not human. Is he? I mean, you're telling me that the character has a resemblance to real people. I mean, that's a part of my question, is did you believe in him?
Mm-hmm.
Did you believe he was a real person?
The story was not about him. It was about her.
Right.
And they developed what was going on in her mind.
Absolutely.
And just kind of let him be the epitome of evil and let you see how she dealt with it.
So that whoever he may have been, what we see is who he was to her.
That's right.
And to her, he was nothing but the oppressor.
He was just straight oppression. And there's plenty of circumstances in the world where people feel that same kind of unrelenting oppression with no other options.
Yeah.
With no options.
What about...
Does that make his death okay?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Does that make his death okay?
It sure felt okay when it happened the first time you read it.
Doesn't
it? You stop to think about it. You don't like what your reaction is, but it felt just fine.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that interesting that we have a frontline emotional response?
I don't think it made his death okay, but I think that he was facing the consequences of his actions. And we never escape the consequences, even when we're forgiven by God, totally and completely. We still never escape the consequences of our sin on earth, is it? From earth, or from the people around us, or... The consequences are always.
And it's interesting that at the very beginning of the story, she says to him about his scaring her with the whip,
You ain't got no business doing it. God knows it's a sin. Someday I'm going to drop dead from some of your foolishness. So those are the terms in which she's naming it, too, that it's that he's sinning against her, sinning against her body. But what most gets to her is when he sins against her spirit. And the presence of the snake in the house, she says, has just eaten up her insides.
I had the feeling he put that box out there to try to drive her from the house, and that he wasn't originally trying to murder her. But it didn't work. She just pushed through that.
That's right. And that goes along with, that ties in interestingly with what Bob is talking about in terms of the escalation of the resistance. That when, for him, the threat of violence only provokes resistance in her, then he moves to carry out the violence.
One thing that worries me for a woman like that who has so recently been passive and then him dying a death like he did, she will probably have guilt feelings forever about that. And I think she will suffer more than she needs to over this death just because she's a woman and she was programmed to that.
Do you hear that in the story? Is that
not
a concern?
Especially.
Yeah.
Not especially.
Yeah. The story gives me hope in the way it talks about this clarifying rage. That she,
I guess I have a hard time believing that somebody can.
I do too. I do too. And go ahead, Kate.
When he threatens her spirit or her soul or her body, she doesn't strike back. But when he threatens her house, which is the only thing that gives her body any comfort, and the church gives her soul comfort, but the house with his little flowers and friends is the only thing that gives her. When he threatens that, I think that's the catalyst for her. It's like, you know, somebody threatening you or threatening your child. That might be the difference for you. If somebody threatened your child, you might be capable of a great number of things.
What about her? Do you believe in her? Is she a believable character to you?
I don't know. How many years? 15 years of this abuse?
It goes on all the time. Lots of times it's 30 or 40.
Okay.
There we go. Democratic belief in character.
Because I just got done taking a domestic violence class. That's why. Because they don't ever want to give up their hope. You know. So if they give up their hope, then they're doomed. And so, you know, it's just a process. You know.
I think this is kind of coming from a very different world than most of the people, or maybe even all the people in this room, because I personally can't imagine this in my life, because I know where I'm coming from. That's not going to be there. But, I mean, we've gotten that influence of, we can see that, we see it, it's distanced from us, and we know that it won't happen to us. But the influence of the South, of the slavery, of the oppression, we hear a lot about it, so we can at least identify it in that way.
I'm not sure I understand what she's saying, but it certainly is not confined to race or class or economic circumstances.
But if it's not in your life now, it may not get in your life.
That's basically what I'm saying.
Although the image of the snake and the whip and the bed and how the husband and the bed come together kind of reflects to me the sadomasochism that's underlying a lot of human relationships in our culture, too. And they're subtle. They're ones I can't come up with a statement right off the bat, but how many of us have dreams of snakes attacking us somehow? And I think that comes from experiences of people using power and using it in abusive ways.
Well, and also to the extent to which relations between men and women are relations of power, even when they're benign, then the potential can be there for that to change, for that to turn.
I think one thing that was noticeable in this story, too, was that she was the economic power in the household. His death would not impoverish her because she was self-supporting.
That's right. And that brings me back to this as a story about work, which you'll remember was the title under which we were considering this. What is the place of work in this woman's life? Pardon?
Her house.
Her house. But I didn't mean what is the literal place of work. I meant what is the importance of work?
It's her tower. Constant work.
It's her life, it's her power, it's survival, but it's constant, isn't it? It's ever present from Sunday to Sunday.
It's a whole pattern. It's not even something. It's like wearing clothes. You know, it's so much a driven in part of her daily, her life.
And the men talk about it, it's a routine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Cycle.
The work itself sounds like awful drudgery, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Taking in other people's washing, bringing it home, sorting it out, soaking it in galvanized tubs, and you can imagine that she had those washing boards and she had to, her hands are all gnarled, and you can imagine what that does to your skin and to your knuckles, and it's just constant.
It shows the kind of character she is, because you put great value on her work, and she put great value. She was proud of it. People talked about it.
That's
she
right.
was good at it,
That's
and
right.
she cared about it, even
That's
if
right.
it was white folks' clothing.
That's right. It gave her a place in that community, didn't it? She was as regular as anything. They always knew Adelia would be there. It bought her that house and the little flowers and the sense of security.
The pony,
and she yells at him about the pony. Don't you whip that pony. I feed that pony. He's not made for your bullwhip.
And don't you step on my clean white clothes.
Yeah, and don't you step on my clean white clothes. And that's the first thing we see him doing, isn't it? Is aggressing on her work, is sabotaging her work. And he says to her, I don't want no white man's washing in my house.
She doesn't feel sorry for herself at all, though, because of her work.
No, she doesn't.
It doesn't
does
impress
she?
Her at all. Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the only joy
her work
she has.
Is her power.
Yeah.
Simple. Every day she knows she's going to have that work,
mm-hmm.
and that's consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And he isn't. You don't know where he's going to be, what he's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she would go through with the plan was probably possible, partly because.
Yeah, that's right. She knew she was going to have.
She could survive without
right,
him.
Right. She was going to have a livelihood, and I think that. In cases where we see domestic violence today, one of the primary factors that determines whether a wife will be able to get herself out of that situation or whether she'll be stuck in it is her confidence that she can support herself, that she's got a means to survive, because that dependence, that economic dependence, is a powerful thing to keep people locked in a job, in a relationship.
Yeah.